Welcome to the London Welsh Rugby Club podcast. This is episode 49. Three key pieces of information prior to introducing our guest this week. First and foremost, a project very close to my heart is that the club have launched a Colts Academy. We are putting a bit more emphasis on this as we want more of our players transitioning from Colts rugby to our senior squads. I would like to thank the board and Kai support for this initiative, and I look forward to seeing things develop and evolve over the coming years. Aldi Park is now open for outside drink service. Please check their website for opening hours and support your local sports club where possible. Now, this Saturday is a perfect opportunity to do this when playing members from our women's, men's, Colts and Touch Rugby Club are playing Touch Rugby on the first team pitch from 1:30. The sun will be out. What better way to spend an afternoon than having a couple of drinks down the club, watching some rugby, but please respect all social distancing rules. Our guest this week is someone who's achieved so much in the game across his rugby career. A Newcastle legend with their most premiership appearances, he started the Toulon European Odyssey down in France, came back to premiership and played for the Saints, and then came to London Welsh. He has seen both sides of the club, being a paid professional and captain when we were in the premiership, and then backs coach and player in our second season since Project Reset. We chat quite a bit about his playing days, but also dig into the varied roles Tom has had once he's finished playing the game, and also what techniques he uses to keep himself fit and sane in this mad world we live in. Our guest this week is Tom May. Enjoy. This podcast is sponsored by London Welsh Developments. London Welsh Developments offer the entire range of services for all your home needs, from plumbing, electrical, joinery, and building and maintenance. Their many years of experience building all forms of extensions and conversions, the odd new build, and some bespoke garden rooms and home offices. You will clearly see the attention to detail and an understanding of your home that is difficult to match. They really do care and want the best for your home with no stone left unturned. For more information, contact London Welsh Developments on 0208 335 9123 or email on info@lwdltd.co.uk, London Welsh Developments. Welcome to the pod, former Newcastle, Toulon, Northampton, England and London Welsh captain Tom May. How are you, Tom?
I'm good, thanks. Good to be with you on a very grey Saturday morning.
Yeah, but a European Champions Cup weekend and Six Nations for the women, so plenty of rugby on the telly for us. But look, more importantly, how has 2021 been for you and your family? You must be looking forward to the lockdown easing, but like all of us.
Oh, Monday can't come soon enough with the opening of pubs. I mean, just the thought of being allowed in someone's back garden at the moment is an absolute mind spinner. Look, it's been tough for everyone for various different reasons, isn't it? Everyone's got a different way in which they found lockdowns hard. For the first lockdown, I think Becky and I basically spent a lot of time drinking rosé as it came towards the weekends, because we had a crazily good weather, didn't we?
Yeah.
And the second one was a bit less, and then this one I've just been really boring, so I'm just waiting to get out the other side of it. So look, it's not a great start, and I don't think anyone could have predicted where we are now, but you know, at least we've got light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, I think even the Aldi Park is opening up on Monday to serve some beers to those people who come and play touch rugby. So I think that there's already oversubscribed the amount of players who are able to train. But look, that's great. But you're a person who looks like you keep fit a lot, and you probably would have used this as an opportunity to maintain or increase your fitness, I'd imagine.
Yeah, so obviously loads of gyms had to close, didn't they, during lockdown. So I actually spoke to CrossFit in Sunbury. So I appeared one morning with a ski erg in my house. Becky was like, what are you doing? They're massive sort of bits of equipment. That ended up in our house that we were using for a period of time. And then she's obviously a PT, so we always got bits of equipment about. So I spent a lot of time looking at that. I was doing some running during the early part of the year, which has basically stopped me doing any running since. But I think what it for someone that's come from professional sport where you're quite goal oriented, you're very focused on what is ahead. If, you know, as Boris has gone, right, we're not going out for 8 weeks, 9 weeks, whatever longer, I've gone, right, what can I get in or get out of the next 8 weeks that can turn it into a bit of a positive and use it as a bit of a challenge? So actually, over the last period of time, I've been working with a former professional rugby player, Jake Abbott, who used to play for England Sevens and Worcester. And he's now a sort of a training coach, and he's been helping me with my nutrition and stuff like that. Now, I know a fair bit about nutrition, but I'm stood in the kitchen working and I'm 6 foot from the kids' snack cupboard. It's just an absolute nightmare. And actually, if I pay someone, I'm held accountable to it. So there's no point in me paying someone if I'm going to go and sneak a, you know, party rings out of Evie's snack box. So I've been using it for those reasons. I've got a bit of, apart from being on here now with you, Gareth, of course, I've got a bit of Zoom fatigue with it, with meetings.
Yeah.
Because you just back up one into another, don't you? And I think it's then becomes very difficult to break your day up. I think for me though, lockdown can be manageable, palatable in many ways, but for me, it's the effect that it has on kids that's been the hardest. You know, our kids have definitely changed, and now seeing them go back the other way, now they're allowed to do something. I'm sat here in the peace and quiet because my daughter's off doing 3 hours of dance, and Oscar's back in mini rugby tomorrow, and he can't wait. And it just feels like a bit more normal, doesn't it? Rather than, you know, cooped up in a house and not being allowed to do anything and walking in a park for the 50th time in the day.
Yeah, no, actually, I want to go into that because you like to get up early, and I think you're the sort of person who will look at what you are able to do, not what you're not able to do. So, of course, on the positive side of things, and you like literally go out walking most days, like 5:30, 6 o'clock, with a mate or on your own, and sort of clear your head and set yourself up for the day ahead. Is that right?
Yeah, I had a chat with it was a couple of years ago now with a guy called Richie Norton, and we'd had a few beers, to be honest, but he was telling me about you need to just get, because I've got a bad back and I'm pretty stiff as it is, so just get up, get mobile, get active. And there weren't many things that stuck with me from that afternoon due to the amount of beers that did. And actually having seen, obviously Will Taylor does it, you do it, get up early, get out, go running. Some of the things you get to see at that time of day are unreal and no one else gets to see it. And I actually read a book once called The 5 AM Club. It's about getting up ahead of everyone else, what you can get in before everyone else is asleep, awake, sorry. I'm sort of waking up 5:15, 5:30 every day. I'm out the door, and I'm only, 3 minutes from Bushy Park. So I'm into Bushy Park. And I'll walk for 45 minutes to an hour. I'll have a coffee with a mate of mine if he drags himself out of bed, and then come back and I start my day then. But I find it a great way to sort of A, get up and be mobile, because my body needs to wake up before it does anything, and also it clears my head. I try as much as I stick my Strava on, and I obviously take a few photos here and there that bores everyone to tears in my sunrise photos, but I think I try and stay off my phone, because large parts of the day I'm either on my laptop or my phone working, and just use it as a bit of like, no one's talking to me, I don't have to talk to anyone, and if I'm with my mate, we're talking absolute garbage anyway, so you know, it's happy days. It's a great time of the day. It's pretty rank during the winter, when it's pitch black, freezing cold, but if you wrap up warm, it sort of clears your mind, get some fresh air in your lungs. Brilliant.
Fresh air, moving forward. There's no such thing as bad weather, just bad clothing, a coffee, coffee afterwards. And
it's
also
all about bad prep.
Exactly. And also on those walks, people can listen to the London Welsh Rugby Club podcast, can't they? Do you know what I mean? Or if it's not then, they can use it to fall asleep in the evening. Do you know what I mean? So, probably not this episode. But look, you've also, I think, been quite active in helping other people stay fit. And, you know, I think you've been doing, like you said, Zoom fatigue, but using your experience to like help others maintain or get fitter during this time. And I think Chris Jenkins has been involved again, and Paul Doran Jones as well. I think you've been helping them.
So it all came about. I finished a run around London last year. Obviously, I ran past you a couple of times, didn't I? I'm hanging out my arse as I was sort of trawling my way through Richmond. But I finished on the day of England Wales at Twickenham. And I think the week later, we went into lockdown.
Yeah.
And because I'd basically just been running, I was feeling really good, really active. And then you can't do anything. And I was chatting to a couple of friends of mine. They were like, look, our kids are going up the walls. Can we not do something with them? So it started off, right, let's do something with the kids, because my kids are the same. You know, they have their breakfast in the morning. If they can sneak some TV in, they can. If they can nick someone's phone or a screen, they'll do it. And I just needed to get them up and be active. And I thought what Joe Wicks was doing was brilliant.
Yeah.
My kids got bored with that after about 10 days. But I think it was, in terms of what it did, was it set kids up brilliantly. And so I started doing some stuff in the garden. And it was brilliant. So I'm still doing it now with probably a hardcore of about 8 people. It's just a great way to train with people when you're not allowed.
Yeah.
You know, I basically set the sessions and do what I want to do. And then they all sort of come in and join. And it's great fun. And I actually recently, in the latest lockdown, I did some stuff with Chobham Rugby Club, Old Guildfordians and Brighton, right. The new dads at each. And there was, I don't know, the maximum I had one that, and I was doing it in my room in Ireland because I was commentating on must have been Six Nations game. So I had about 70 kids.
Wow.
It's awesome. You know, just seeing them up, get, you know, all their different rooms, where they're doing it, what they're trying to sort of jump around. It was brilliant. And the effort they were putting in. I was struggling physically to sort of keep going through the week and not have, because I need my rest days now. Mm-hmm. But I'm, as Becky would say, I very rarely give myself, I don't rest enough. So actually now not doing it on a Sunday, it's actually quite nice. And it's brilliant that they're back being able to do mini rugby. But it was so good to be able to like do that, have something to get up for. Do you know what I mean?
100%. You know, kids need focus, need a challenge, need like an appointment. And as you say, you know, we had all the kids and youth back last week at London Welsh. And just, you know, even for an Easter Sunday, we would never normally train on Easter Sunday, but we did. And it was packed with kids.
And it was busy, was it?
I was busy. I mean, probably one of our best attendances ever. And people running around, they were just so pleased to see each other. Even like the under 18 lads, like they're all like, you know, shoulders into each other, you know, fist pumps, and just and we had like 35 under 18s there, which is unbelievable.
Brilliant.
Yeah,
so it's so good. But I think it highlights what, like, I've learned a fair bit about more about myself during these lockdowns, and I've realized what we're all social creatures, right, which is why lockdown is so difficult. But I've realized that seeing family, seeing friends, being out and about, being active, being able to go places and be with people is really important to me. I thought I was quite sort of happy to be on my own and just chill out, and I'm not. I'm climbing up the walls now. It's, you know, and being able to go somewhere and just chat with someone that's completely different, I think is that's what we've missed. And I think it's, hopefully there'll be some good to come out of the back of this.
Yeah, it's the human connections. It's not anything materialistic. It's just the connections, you know. So, you know, being around a rugby club with, you know, you don't know people's names, but you know their faces, that sort of thing. It's really important. But look, you've been busy during this lockdown working on rugby as well. You mentioned you're in Ireland, so you commentate on rugby as well, as you know, as one of your many roles you do in life. So you're working for the Six Nations because you're in Italy and you're in Ireland, and then also you're commentating, I think, on Rugby Europe, weren't you, with Nick Heath on the Russia games.
I mean, I've had to polish up. Yeah, I got Georgia, Romania, and Russia. I mean, you can't, like, sort of difficult names. It's like, what? And I was doing those from my bedroom. And I know you saw me in my son's gaming sort of headphones. And I mean, I swore down I would never wear gaming headphones. And there I was, back in my bedroom, commentating with Nick Heath, who was in his bedroom.
You wouldn't know watching it. Because I watched it on Rugby Europe, because it's free to watch on Rugby Europe.
Yeah.
Because of the London Welsh interest, I watched the Georgia Russia game, and it was 0-0 for quite a long time, wasn't it? I think that match.
But
those pronunciations would have been quite challenging. So would you have done a lot of prep on that?
So the media manager will send you like a audio file with the names on.
Right.
So you get to listen to them, make sure, because let's face it, there's nothing worse than someone getting your name wrong, and you always hear it on. Well, you don't always hear it now, but you used to always hear it a fair bit. Someone like two different people pronouncing the same name differently in the same game. And it's like, oh, you know, it's not great. So spend a bit of time doing that. But it's amazing how you can actually do that now. You know, you've got a camera crew in Georgia, or where were they? They were in Tbilisi, they were in Sochi. So the camera crew sends a feed. The feed gets sent to Paris. So the guys that I was working with were in Paris. The game was in Sochi or Tbilisi. I was in Teddington and Nick's in Tooting. And it's, you know, and you pull it all together and actually you're commentating on something. And the stream dropped out a couple of times and obviously occasionally it didn't quite work, but that's technology, isn't it? And you're at the sort of the mercy of technology in some ways. And on the flip side of that, having worked on the Six Nations and also in the Autumn Nations Cup. So I went to, where was I? Florence in November, and then Dublin and Rome for the Six Nations. But to be able to, I mean, Becky was calling it a holiday. You're going on holiday. Well, if you're having four COVID tests in 6 days, that's no holiday. So it was brilliant to be able to break it up, you know, is all I'm saying. Because, you know, you'd leave on a Friday, get back on a Sunday or a Monday morning or whatever. And brilliant to be able to do something like that and stay involved with the game. But yeah, I've been lucky and hopefully there's more opportunities to get involved in things like that.
Do you enjoy it? Because I was talking to Ed Jackson in one of these episodes, and he's on Channel 4, obviously, quite a lot. Yeah. And he's literally had no training. His first game was Bath to lose the Freddie Burns drop try incident. And he was there live on TV, literally no training. So have you had any formal training at all from any of the broadcasters you use? Or is it just, you know, go with the flow and learn from your experience?
I think some of the... I started off doing punditry. So in the studio when Sky had loads of rugby, and I think it was probably European rugby that I commentated on first, worked on first, just shoved into the studio. Remember when rugby was on ESPN as well? I used to do that. I've had no coaching at all, so you sort of learn over time, and then obviously commentary is a slightly different skill, and co-commentary is a different skill. It's different from radio to TV. Radio, you can't have silence.
Yeah.
And you keep on having to refer back to the situation, whether it be the score or the whatever's going on, just to paint the picture. Whereas TV, you can be silent for a bit. And you pick up little things like that. So the World Cup in Japan, which was amazing, was primarily radio. Whereas now all the stuff I'm doing is basically world feed TV. So anywhere outside of the UK that's watching the Six Nations is my commentary. Yeah. Whereas all of the other stuff is just feeding into the UK.
No, of course, it's great to be involved. And also, you feature on Brian Moore's Telegraph podcast quite a lot. And so there's quite a lot of media work, but it's very competitive, isn't it, in rugby? Because lots of people want to get into that side of things. So it's you know, there's no sort of set career path, is there, in that either?
No, and I think, you know, like I said this too. It's obviously very difficult for all wives, girlfriends, partners, whatever, that are left behind when you go to something like the World Cup for so long.
I'm
waiting for the comments to come. And she says she'll keep quiet. So you have to, there has to be a reason to stay out that long. Now, I had a contract with World Feed Radio for the group games. And then I noticed that a lot of people were going home. So I was like, well, if I could stay out. And so I did TalkSport from the start to the finish as a sort of reporter. And I did other bits and bobs for various different people. But if I hadn't have been there, or if certain teams had continued, then there would have been less jobs. But you're right, everyone wants to do it.
Yeah.
And if you you get an opportunity, and this is the hard thing, you get an opportunity, you can't turn it down. Because who knows where Rugby Europe's going to be in a few years' time. You know, who knows who's coming around the corner. There's always people dropping out of rugby due to injury or whatever, that's, you know, the next cab off the rank. And you don't want to miss, you know, you don't want to miss something and miss your slot.
Well, you can see them, can't you? The people who are, you know, just left international rugby, you know, like John Barkley's getting a lot of work now, you know, and then Danny Kerr's doing well. It's just that next sort of generation coming through. But look, you do a great job. And, you know, with us tuning to the Telegraph podcast, I love it. But another thing you're doing at the moment is this future-proof pro. You sort of live your life loudly, Tom, and you also like talk about the challenges of transitioning from pro sports to real world, I suppose. And you're now involved in a company that helps others to do that.
Yeah, so it's something I've looked at for years, and I had initial conversations way back when I was still at Newcastle, I think, with John Slighthome. He used to play on the wing for England and Northampton. His son's actually in the Northampton team now.
Yeah.
And we were looking at how players transition. So, yes, the RPA is there and they're doing a brilliant job, but they're very focused on the educational and the vocational skills that they can provide rugby players in career. And that's the same across all sorts of different governing bodies. What's really difficult for bodies like that is then to go, we've got such a diverse portfolio of players that could want to do anything from marketing to finance, from, I don't know, running a coffee shop to starting their own tech business. Mm-hmm. You know, how can they help that diversity of people 100%? It's really difficult for them. So I looked at it again, maybe a year and a half ago. And again, it felt like I was scratching the surface because it's a massive problem. Mm-hmm. And then I got a phone call in lockdown one, James Hitchman, who's the founder of the business, had rung me and basically said, look, I've heard you're really interested in this. We'd love to get you on board. Cause they got John Slighthome on board, and effectively we now fill the gap so that athletes can make confident transitions from sport. Mm-hmm. So if they know that they're going to be finishing, or they have an injury and they know it's not probably going to recover, then we can start working with them. We put them in different groups so that, you know, those that are quite a long way away sit in a bronze group, silver are moving up closer to that transitional point, and gold are ready to go or looking for roles. We've got six partners, four of whom have a massive experience in recruitment. So they understand what people are looking for, what CVs should look like, what different skill sets are required for different industries. And then from the sporting side, myself and John lead on helping them make that transition, adjust mentally, and then also use our network to drag in sports people or corporates that are interested in that pool of talent.
Yeah.
because it's not really an accessed pool of talent. But if you think about what the transitional skills are, very goal orientated, very driven, motivated, flexible. That's not physically. Yeah. That's in terms of adapting to situations and learning quickly. Open to criticism, things like that, that sports people have to deal with all the time. Actually, if you put that into a workplace and you channel that effectively, I think it can be quite a strong and powerful tool. So, Future Proof has been set up. We're now placing, one of our first placements was Ollie Steadman.
Okay.
Yeah. Who was obviously at London Welsh.
Yeah.
Had his career cut short pretty brutally by some of the clubs that he was involved with. And he went up against some very experienced candidates for his role, had no experience himself and smashed it out of the park and got the role. And I think that proves to us that there's a huge opportunity for athletes. So we're not just talking to rugby players. That's where we started for obvious reasons, but we're now a team of about 12 or 13 that are at it all the time, trying to help.
That's great to hear. And maybe what goes in hand with that maybe is you're an app ambassador for Mindspace 24/7 as well, aren't you? So that, because mental well-being is really to the fore. I work at Virgin Media. They do a lot of things in this space. So you started getting involved with that now as well. Does that help with Future Proof as well, do you think, when things are that?
Yeah, I think... the email should remain nameless, but we had an email this week which was really a cry for help. We'd been talking about this with Future Proof, in that the people that come to us will be mentally fragile, is probably a good word.
Yeah.
Because no matter what front you put on, you're always going to find points in that transition difficult. We're now talking to Mindspace 247, because I've dragged the two together. Now I've stepped out because I'm sort of got a foot in both camps. I want them to see the opportunity and themselves. But Mindspace 247 has been an interesting role that I've got, in that it's been set up by Guy Outram and a guy called Barney Battles, who's a serial entrepreneur, very successful man. Guy Outram's actually Ollie Phillips' stepdad. And he's got a huge business experience. They're very passionate about this mental health and well-being, and also mental health and well-being within the workplace, a bit like you just mentioned with Virgin Media. Providing those corporates, for example, with a confidential helpline where they can just ring up, and they know that no one's going to find out about it. They don't have to talk to anyone about it, but they can talk to someone at the end of the phone, and that can be their sort of reach out for help, I think, is really important. And as well set up as I was, or I felt I was, to finish playing rugby after that season where we got absolutely battered, physically I was ready to step away. I think... it took me 3 years to stop sort of the rocking motion of transition. Mm-hmm. I think also I've realized over time that there were actually periods in my life and my career where I was finding things mentally tough, but actually a sport like rugby doesn't really allow you the opportunity to show any weakness. Because if you show weakness in a changing room, 30 blokes jump into that crack. Sport is evolving, and that doesn't necessarily happen as much now, but I think it's really important that, and my friends and family would definitely say I haven't been very good at talking about stuff or my emotions or what's bothering me. Hopefully I'm now, I think by pinning my colours to the mast with Mindspace 247, I believe in what they're doing, but also it'll mean that I have to do if I'm not doing what I'm talking about, it stands out like a sore thumb. So it's a really interesting business, and I'm looking forward to helping.
No, it's great you're doing that. It's great. You're a very busy person, but let's go back to the beginning and how you really got into rugby. That's the thing that fascinates me, because when and where did you get into rugby? Tom?
Watching my dad, probably like every other child, I reckon. Watch their parents. I remember running around at Old Alanians, which is, my dad was at Dulwich College, and he went and played for Old Alanians, which is just up the road from where we lived in Dulwich. And I used to go out there, watch him. He'd go inside with mum and, you know, get smashed in the clubhouse. And I would just be outside running around in the mud, head to toe. I loved it. I couldn't get enough of it. And then I played mini rugby at Old Beckhamians in where's that? That's West Wickham. And then I played for Richmond, junior rugby. And okay. Then I went away to school. So I went to boarding school in Kent. So I played for Sevenoaks, and then I went back to Richmond after I finished school.
So did you play for Tonbridge School and Sevenoaks at the same time?
Yeah, Saturdays and Sundays when that was allowed, because it's not allowed now, is it?
and that does affect your local rugby club as well. You know, lots of children go to privately educated, but cannot play for their clubs on a Sunday. So that does make.
I think that's. Listen, there's a safety element, of course, and we need to look after kids and all this stuff. We can't wrap them in cotton wool, and they only learn by playing. And if they're training with their schools on a weekend, and then they're not allowed to play on a Sunday for their clubs, I don't think that's right.
They have games on a Wednesday and a Saturday probably for school, and three games a week. It's maybe, especially when you get to 15, 16, 17, it becomes challenging. But, you know, I've got a big thing about, you know, yeah, school till you're 18, your club's there for life, you know, and, you know, that's the thing schools don't always appreciate, because they're trying to get great results by hiring former rugby players to come and coach there so they could just win and do well. But I don't think there's a duty of care to the child there, where, you know, they should be to get, they squeeze a lot out of those children, where actually, where's a sense of fun and enjoyment and camaraderie when you'd get more of that maybe at your rugby club. But look, I don't want to bang on about that too much.
No, I agree with you though. Like, I think a lot of these schools, you're right, especially those that, you know, push the boundaries with rugby, want success. So their main focus will be on those first, you know, the top teams in each age group. That's not what rugby's about. Rugby's about meeting mates and experiencing different things.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, the more and more I talk about my career now, that the older I get, the more I look back and go, actually, it wasn't necessarily about the rugby. It's about your mates. It's about the things you got up to. It's about whether you want to remember those or not, the memories you have from all of those different places, the opportunities it gave you. That's what it's about. And I'm trying to sort of explain that to Oscar right now. You know, rugby's not about being on the telly and, you know, doing this, that, and the other. Rugby's about having fun with your mates.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important sort of differential, because it changes when you become professional.
Yeah. You know, at the mini level, it should be about the sausages and chips after the game. So you forget about the results straight away. Do you know what I mean? So
I'm all about a coffee and a bacon bat when I'm watching mini rugby.
But you get to chat to the parents. But look, you went back to Richmond then after you finished school to play. But did you have any age grade stuff after, you know, playing for Tonbridge and Sevenoaks? When did you get into age grade England stuff?
No, the only age grade England stuff I played was England school, England under 18s.
Right.
I think it picked up before that. And the only reason I got that under 18, I'd come back from a school skiing trip and I was getting picked up from Dover by my dad on a Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. And I got there, didn't know anything about it. He said, oh, you've been invited to a final trial for someone who dropped out for London and South East at Rosslyn Park. Do you want to do it? And I was like, had a week skiing with my mates and I can't really be bothered. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I ended up going. I was on the possibles against the probables. I got swapped in to the probables at half time, and our back line was, I can't remember who the scrum half was. Half decent though. Then Johnny Wilkinson at fly half, Simon Amor at inside centre, at probably the smallest inside centre on the planet. And then I was at outside centre. Dave Flatman was involved, John Dawson, Sheridan. And I got picked for London South East Schools. Then we won that sort of regional tournament. And then I ended up in the London England Schools final trial, played that, got into that. And that's how it was, just one chance game. And that's, I think, comes back to the opportunities, isn't it?
Yeah.
You get an opportunity, just do it. You don't know what's going to happen off the back of it.
Look at that. That one moment, though, you said no to that. Your whole career might not have happened in a way.
Whole career could have changed.
Yeah.
I might never, ever have had the opportunity to do what I have done. And I've carried that on. So I'm never shy of having a coffee with someone that might be a really odd sort of meeting, because you never know what they're into, what they want to meet you about, what they want to talk about, or where the opportunities might lie. And I think there's a lot of people who go, oh, I can't be bothered to go and have this coffee with someone, or can't meet this person. Who knows what's going to happen?
So did you go from there to Richmond and play for Richmond? Because was this the late 90s when they had the professional and, Ben Clark, Quinnells, Adrian Davis from London Welsh was playing for them at the time.
P-Show.
Did you get to play for them, or were you in that squad training?
Yeah.
Or what happened?
So I was in their sort of a development squad, and I ended up playing a few second team games. And then I would sort of get picked on the bench and maybe a couple of first team appearances in that old Cheltenham and Gloucester Cup.
Right.
It was like it was horrible. Tuesday night rugby. And I played alongside Mel Dean in the centre, and who obviously went on to play for Quins and Sale. Tom Whitford in the centre, who then he went to play in Perpignan and Toulon, ended up being team manager for Toulon. And when I went down there to have a look around, I didn't even know he was there. I'm like, hey, what are you doing here? He's still out there. He's now with Montpellier. But I came back from sort of being at school, living with mum and dad again. And then I played at Richmond for a year. And then I went up to the Northeast.
How did that come about then? Because obviously, Newcastle, John Hall had invested into Newcastle. They were, I don't want to say Galacticos, there's some star quality at Newcastle at the time. And Johnny was there, because who you played with earlier. So, you go up into that, at that time, we'd had Rob Andrew, Doddy Weir, Tony Unwood, Jamie Noon. So it's an environment to walk into for a 19-year-old, I imagine.
Yeah, so there was a group of us. Myself, Nooney, Michael Stevenson, Dave Walder, Hall Charlton, we all went in at the same time. And it came part of us. There's a guy called Paul McKinnon who used to run the sort of development / academy at Newcastle. And what they used to do was, when Newcastle were playing Richmond, for example, at the Athletic Ground in the Premiership, the development squad would play before.
Right.
So we played against Newcastle. And then he came up to me afterwards and he said, look, would you be interested in coming to Newcastle? I'd been playing England under 19, which was England Colts at the time, with Mickey Ward, who was from Newcastle. So I think he'd watched Mickey in those games and seen me. And then I ended up going up there, had a look around. Johnny met me and took me round, and I was a bit like, well, yeah, why not? So I went up there. My predictions for my exams, given the amount of rugby that I had been playing in my last year at school, my predictions weren't great. And they're obviously the ones that try and get you through to university. So ENU wasn't getting me anywhere. I ended up getting ABC at A-level. So retrospectively, they helped me get in. So that was great. So I actually went to Newcastle University, finished an undergrad degree. Then I went back to university after a year and did a postgrad at Northumbria. So I did both universities out there. Brilliant. It's a Newcastle University town or city. And it's a brilliant, brilliant part of the world. Too cold for me, but it's Baltic out there.
Yeah, for someone who likes the sun, 10 years up north. But look, we had a... amazing time. Alan Chilton was there as well, wasn't he, when you were there? And he made about 90 appearances for London Welsh after he'd been at Newcastle.
Yeah.
Look,
10 great years, Newcastle. You scored two tries in a technically bitter cup fight against Quins. You beat Sale a few years later in the Power Gen Cup. You know, you're the most capped Newcastle player. You're a proper, legend, of that club.
It's quite strange. Like, I love going back there and watching them or working on games. And it's great to see them doing so well now. Struggled a bit, obviously, recently.
Yeah.
But I think they've done well since they come up. I just think they're a bit of a sleeping giant, actually. I think they've got the opportunity with the right setup, with the right vision, that they could make a big impact again on Premiership rugby. Their catchment area is enormous. You look at Leicester, Worcester, Wasps, Saints, and that squabble of sort of in and around England, in Middle England. It's in terms of the numbers, they're spread all over the place. But I think Newcastle got a real opportunity.
Well, Mike Brown's gone up there for next season, isn't he? He's a bit of star quality, shall we say, towards the end of his career, but he's still playing well. So
What they need to do, I think. They've got some good young lads. Yeah. Now they need to go and get some proper, five or six really big names.
Yeah, it costs money, doesn't it? It costs money to do that. Look, that's a challenging time. But whilst you're at Newcastle, that's when you got your sort of England sort of senior involvement. So you were involved in sevens for a bit, England A, and you were capped by Martin Johnson, I think, in 2009 on the tour to Argentina when they came over here. When you look back at your international career, what are your sort of main reflections of it, really?
Frustrated I didn't get more caps. I was in and around those England squads for years.
Yeah.
And doing my head in. I mean, I had some pretty stiff competition. Mike Catt, Mike Tindall, Will Greenwood, Jamie Noon, which is not easy when he's your teammate. But look, I achieved my goal, and that was to play for England. Would I like to have done it more? Of course I would have liked to have done it more. Do I feel I could have coped at that level? Yes. I think, and I've talked about it before, I think I've talked about it on the good, the bad and the rugby, which is obviously nowhere near as decent a podcast as this, Gary. The struggles I had in believing in myself as a player, I think actually led to me not playing as much. I was more than capable. I had what I needed in terms of my sort of toolkit. I think it was the way I applied it mentally that held me back. I was always worried about what people were thinking rather than going, right, this is me, stop me type thing. And I, there was a couple of conversations I had with Clive Woodward, and he said, oh, well, I'm looking for this, that, and the other in my sort of midfield. And I try and change my game to fit that rather than thinking, well, hang on a minute, I'm in an England squad and I'm not doing any of that. It was difficult. I mean, playing England sevens was absolutely savage. Great to have done it, but... I mean, Joe Lydon took me out of a 15 setup. I didn't have any fitness preparation or anything. I got chucked into two 7 series events, which out of all of the places all over the globe could have been, were London and Cardiff.
We lucked out with Cardiff, but
lucked out. I mean, I managed to go to the walkabout afterwards. Great. that was my experience from that. But of all of the places I could have gone, but oh my God, it was brutal. Just... the fitness of those, I mean, now is a different, it's completely alien.
You have to be like sort of 30-35% fitter. That's what everyone sort of says, but you've lived it. Is it more than that, probably? Yeah.
Horrific. Yeah. You get, I learned pretty quickly, do not get stuck in the middle defensively. Oh, it is horrendous. You're just going from one side to the other. It's a bit like playing scrum half. And I've had to do that a few times, due to yellow cards and things like that. when you're chasing breakdowns, it's just like, oh my God, just stop there. Like take contact away and the ball disappears and you've got to get there. It's horrible.
It's all about you running angles, isn't it, scrum half? It's sort of that sort of bit like referees, you sort of curve around places, no straight lines and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was great to have done it and I wouldn't necessarily have said that it would have been Martin Johnson that gave me my opportunity, but yeah, look, brilliant. Like, shirts upstairs, Oscar's got it on his wall, and it's great to have done it.
Yeah, not many get to achieve it. You've got to be proud of it. I appreciate what you're saying, things like that. But yeah. Weren't you late for the cap presentation of your first cap as well or something? Didn't you disappear after the game?
I think I was with my mum and dad outside Old Trafford. Just like, what are you doing? I was all wandered in like, oh. So we're not playing an away game at Old Trafford in Manchester, which was, I mean, I ticked two boxes there. Played my first cap for England. And one of the stadiums I wanted to play at was Old Trafford. What a place that is. Just when they started moving those games around. I was late. I think I probably got lost in, it was a bit of a rat run of a place as well. So,
But look, you know, 10 great years at Newcastle as well. Then you go and sign for Toulon, right? So how did that
move? I had to look it up on the map.
Yeah, but he did. But how did that move come about? Because, please tell our listeners, because everyone talks about the French rugby and the French culture. It's so different to playing rugby in the UK, maybe more so maybe back then. What was that like for you?
Yeah, so look, I Philippe Saint-André had tried to sign me a couple of times before that, when he was at Sale, and I was actually on holiday. I was in Lee Mears's house in Barbados at the time because Bath players got paid too much, basically. My agent gave me a ring and said, "Do you fancy Toulon?" And I was like, "I'll be quite honest, I don't have a clue where it is." So I looked it up. Saw where it was, and Gareth, mate, if there's a chance of a tan, mate, I'll literally dig it out. So, I felt like my time at the Northeast had run its course. There were various different things that were frustrating me up there. I'd had a good sort of end to my career up there. I spent 8-9 months playing fly half, which was great fun. But it was time to move on. And I didn't think I was going to get another opportunity. Obviously, financially, it was good.
Yeah.
You could tell what Philippe Saint-André had done. He basically recruited grafters and some sort of top name guys that were already there or arrived. Guys like myself, Chris Chesney, Dean Schofield when he arrived, Rory Lamont, Jamie Robinson, probably all similar levels of capability, but weren't shy of working. And then alongside that, Sonny Bill Williams, Johnny Wilkinson, Joe Van Niekerk, proper stars.
Yeah.
And I think what he was trying to do was instill that the English game at the time was way advanced from the French game in terms of professionalism. Mm-hmm. And so the extras that we all did day in, day out, French blokes were like, "What the hell is going on here? I'm normally buggering off home for a tab and a steak and a red wine."
That's the only extras they were doing, wasn't it? Smoking more.
Oh, like, it was unbelievable. They were just like, what the hell's going on here? These guys are nuts. But actually, it started to work for them. I think those early days where he tried to change that mentality actually worked for Toulon in the end. Mm-hmm. I only spent 2 years there, but they were brilliant. I had opportunities to stay in France, but I sort of felt like I'd done the best place,
Mm-hmm.
And then my mind started kicking in towards, well, I need to be back home for when I finish playing.
Yeah.
I think it's really difficult if you retire abroad to then reconnect all the connections that you need to then make that transition or back to transition. But, that was the reason I went back to Northampton. When I was at Toulon, we were allowed to go skiing. We weren't allowed, but no one really said anything. So that must mean you're allowed, right?
Yeah.
So I was on, I remember being on a ski lift and Jim Mallander rang me and I was like, shit, do I answer this or not? Because that noise that a ski lift makes that's really obvious as you go mm-hmm. over the little joint. I was like, I'm going to have to answer it. So I answered it. And obviously my agent had told him where I was
mm-hmm.
and I didn't know. And he said, "Oh, are you skiing?" And I was like, Like, now, what do I do? Do I lie to the bloke straight away, or do I just come out and say, yeah? So I just sat on a ski lift and I was like, Jim, I'm going to be honest with you. I am having a great time skiing. He's like, good to hear it, but we'd like you to come back. Look, going from Newcastle, where a footballing city, but a great sporting city, to two clubs like Toulon, where it's Toulon and Northampton, where it's completely bonkers, was brilliant.
Because obviously, there's all these myths around the owner of Toulon. Murad Brugelal. Yeah, who's very eccentric, and he does his call to arms before the game. And I believe, do all the players then just walk before the game, walk through the crowd to Toulon into the changing room? That must be, yeah. You know, the hairs the back of your neck must stand up. You know, where you got like.
Oh, brilliant. It was so good. So for some reason, it's very French, but in a home game, they'd get you all to meet in the morning. You're not playing till 4 o'clock. So you'd meet at 10 o'clock. Like, why? Don't know, but we did it. And we went to a hotel down the road. I think it was all so this all could be set up. You go down there, everyone has their pre-match meal together. You just sort of lie around in a room on the floor, whatever you're doing. Get strapped up, taped up there, and then come off, pull it like the bus is head to toe in. I mean, it's basically a moving Toulon sort of advert. And, people banging on the bus, pull up, and you pull up 50 meters away from the entrance to the players' tunnel or the players' sort of change room area. And it's only a meter and a half wide, and it's so loud. Everyone kept their headphones on, but there was no, everyone pauses their music and stuff like that, because it was amazing to do that.
Does it get you up for the game as well, though? Does it really,
That crazy pillu pillu as well. Yeah. Mad Morad would get stuck in, like, he was a complete lunatic. He's not involved now, but yeah. He put Toulon on the map.
No, 100%. And so did you, in a way, because, you know, you were successful to a point when you were there, because and probably built the foundations for their success the following sort of 3 years. They won three European Cups, didn't they? Just after you left. But you came runner up in the Champions Cup and the top 14 when you were there, didn't you?
Yeah, it was. Still to this day, I do not know how it happened. We butchered a 20-3 lead over Cardiff in Marseille on a boiling hot day in the southeast of France. I could not tell you how we lost that, but we did. And then we runners up in the top 14 to Clermont. Can't quite remember. We did really well. The best thing about that, I got a bonus for not getting relegated.
Well, for being second,
it was in my contract. So if you finished in the top six, you got a bonus. But if you didn't get relegated, you got another bonus. So I was like, right, okay. By sort of November, it was like, well, that's one bonus.
You got to take the cash when it comes. Look, you went back. You had a great time there. That's great. You were in Northampton, and for London Welsh supporters, probably only you played 53 games for Northampton. It's probably only one game they don't want to talk about, isn't it, for the Noel supporters? It's the game.
I knew it was going to be the game that you asked about as well.
No, exactly. You've been asked about it a few times, but you scored, I think, 43 points for Northampton in 53 games. Nearly 25% of your points were against London Welsh. So we announced the signing of Tom May on the morning of the game, and you scored two tries against us at the Kassam Stadium, which, relegate us, I suppose, in a way. Or send us on our way, doesn't it, anyway? So
I mean, it was pretty awkward.
Yeah.
Completely and utterly scorched Gordon Ross, Sonny Parker and Nick Scott. Nick Scott reckons he was going to catch me, no chance.
He's quick.
he's quick. But I came off the bench. George Peasy lasted about 5 minutes. And I came off the bench and I was like, oh. And we had this move and we'd been practicing it all week because we knew exactly how London Welsh defended. And I just, when it was called, I was like, oh no. this is going to open up like a Red Sea for me. And it did twice. And it was just like, oh my God. But yeah, it was pretty awkward. Jim Malander at the end of the game, obviously everyone comes in and sits down in the changing room. And he was like, you know, great win, fellas, this, that, and the other. But let's just have a moment to reflect on how Tom's feeling right now. He's just relegated the team that he signed for.
You'd have been in talks, obviously, with, it's been reported you were in talks with Leicester Tigers, probably a few other clubs, you know, for your post-Southampton career. You came to London Welsh. Was that with the expectation that they would be still in the Premiership? Or because they were going well for the first half of the season, and what did you not mind that, you know, they were going to be in a championship? No, look,
I had a couple of other different options, one of which was Leicester. But I'm not sure how that would have gone down. having left Northampton and gone to Leicester. But I think the opportunity for me, I'd realised I was probably, 35 by then, 34. And, you can't hang on forever. And I thought to myself, right, this gives me an opportunity to manage my transition out. So I only signed for 1 year. And that was with Lynn Jones.
Yeah.
Signed, sealed and delivered at the Educated Pallet, just over the road. And then he buggered off. But I'd had written into my contract that I was allowed to go on the British and Irish Lions veterans tour to Australia. Remember that?
Yeah. Was it 13?
13, yeah. I was down there. Somehow I got myself onto that when I'd only had two caps for England. Anyway, I'll take it. And then I was captaining a British and Irish Lions veterans tour with people like the Wallace brothers, Colin Charvis. It was like, I was like, this is ridiculous. This is absolutely, what Welshman do we have? We had Arwell Thomas.
Yeah.
That boy can drink. My God.
He didn't play for Lions, did he?
No, I don't think so. Okay. So we played against Australia, what are they called? They had some crazy name. But basically, their sort of vets team as well. Two fixtures, one in Melbourne, one in Sydney. Big 2 weeks. Came back. Justin had obviously arrived while I was away.
Did you have gout when you came back then?
Well, I came back and I was like, right, I need to make a good impression. So I got off the plane at Heathrow, went home, got my kit, and I went straight to the changing room, to training. And they were already out. So I went and said hello to Justin and said, I'll get stuck. He was like, what are you doing here? I was like, I just want to get stuck here, straight in, And the first three passes I got, I dropped. And I was like, I looked at Justin, I was like, I think I'll go home and just sleep it off. So I came back 2 days later and then got stuck in. But look, I wanted to play for one more year. Obviously, that season went pretty well, and to win against Bristol in the fashion that we did, where we absolutely smashed them over two legs. I still love that.
That's the only, you've won trophies in your career. But that's the only league trophy you've won, isn't it? Is that, am I right in thinking that?
Yeah. But I just loved the way that. I mean, they were intent on winning that. And the amount of stick that I was getting, because I saw that as a massive challenge. Mm-hmm. And I think people down in Bristol saw me as the one to prod, because I was like the angry man. And I loved it. You know, the amount of stick I got when we went, because that was second leg was down there,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
And we absolutely pummeled them. Was it in the rain? First one in the rain?
No, the first one at home was in the rain. I watched down at a sports bar in Barcelona, but I was actually at the memorial ground, but with the 200 other London Welsh supporters amongst the 12,000 Bristol fans. And to win both legs, as like we did, was an unbelievable evening and occasion, wasn't it?
Yeah, a few days after was a bit of a blur with the lads. They all ended up in my house, I think, at one point, but not good. I think that was brilliant. And then obviously Justin turned around and said, look, I'd like you to stay on for another year and captain in the Premiership. And I was like, well, not many times you get offered to be a captain in the Premiership. You know, I was never going to say no, but we didn't get through that, did we, until June?
Yeah.
But that whole system back then was just, it's not great now, but it was even worse back then. You couldn't even recruit.
Yes, it's very challenging. You're recruited basically Jan, Feb time of, in the hope you might get promoted.
I don't think you look back at where the club was and how it was run. I don't think we were really in a position to start doing that. So it was like, well, let's just make sure that we're in it first before we start recruiting. And then, so we're talking May, June, mm-hmm. and it's like everyone's done and dusted. You know, all the new recruits from all the other clubs have moved house. And we went in, well, that first game against Exeter, and it was like, it was boiling hot. I think we hung in there for about an hour, and then I think, oh my God, I think everyone's lungs fell out.
I think both seasons we were in the Premiership, we had strong like first 15, that sort of thing. But it's as you get injuries, you know, we our bench maybe a lot of things challenging. But we did sign players like Piriwupu, Lachlan McCaffrey, people like that, didn't we? Ollie Barkley, who played in the Prem.
Yeah, and I think that was the tough bit towards the end was the fact that actually there's probably five or six of us that were quite experienced. And there was a lot of young lads in there, though. And I think it was too much of a disparity between the two, and that the understanding of what was required wasn't quite there. And look, I think it was just hard, you know.
Yeah, look, it was your last season of professional rugby. You knew you were going to retire at the end of the season. Can you still enjoy that season in the Premiership when you're getting beaten every week? Or is it just
I loved it. I just loved the challenge of it.
Yeah.
Physically, I was sore and hurting, but I week in, week out, I'd be up for just trying to ruin someone's party. Look, it was difficult, but you know, I wouldn't have changed it.
No, and that's great. Look, see what happened to London Welsh after you left, and you know, we had a season in the Championship. You then came back and played in our first home game against Staines as an amateur player. So. For nothing, Tom. Just for the love of the game. I loved that because I always don't think, you know, love to see more professional players come back to their local clubs and play. And you can see the Staines lads were trying to get into you all game. But as soon as the game finished, what they do? They all want a selfie, don't they?
Well, I think so. I went back and I played for Sevenoaks as well. It was nothing was below chest height. It was like, I mean, I know I'm quite short, but oh my God. I was having my head taken off left, right, and center. Well, I remember playing at Sevenoaks. It was sort of 6 inches deep in mud, horizontal rain, freezing cold. Blokes were running past me going, "You wish you'd stayed retired, mate, don't you?" And then those Staines lads were like literally taking my heads off. I'm scrapping on the floor and
I remember that. Yeah.
Oh,
but look, I think it adds a bit of stardust. You know, you scored a try in a day. I think the supporters of London Welsh loved seeing you out there, and you can see the quality that you brought to the team then. You know, which was you know, good, really good for our supporters to see that.
Yeah, I mean, it was difficult playing with guys that I was sort of helping coach as well, because you know. I was a bit older. Well, I was a lot older than them all. If I didn't do something because I was blowing out my arse, it'd be a bit like, well, you're telling us to do that all week. You didn't even do it yourself.
they're doing the running for you, aren't they? That's where
I was like Rob Lee, sat in the middle of the park, just pulling string.
No, exactly. Look, so when you were a backs coach, you played three games. You played that infamous, you played some big games for us in that season when you were backs coach. The 0-0 at Old Street Tonings when you were on the wing in that weather. Did you actually touch the ball?
I don't know, but I looked at Kai. I was like, mate, what have you done to me here?
And you also played fullback, though, in our big game against Datchworth, our last home game.
Yeah.
It was quite a sizable crowd, and it was a close game, and it was a great atmosphere in the club.
That was difficult, actually. I'd had about 3 hours. I was commentating for BT the night before in Newcastle, and I had about 3 hours sleep, and I felt awful. I was dropping passes. I was in a bit of a stinking mood as it was. And, you know, when you're just like, I'm off the pace here, I was really frustrated. I looked at Becky at the end of it. I was like, That could be me, I think. I don't want to leave the game feeling shit about it.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like, in my mind, I'm like, maybe I'll give it one more. Kai keeps sending me messages one more year. I'm just like...
Well, we've got a touch rugby tournament next Saturday if you fancy coming down with a bit of touch rugby.
That's got torn hamstring written all over it.
Okay. Well, you've got so many interests and jobs. You've got to look after your family first and foremost. We understand that. Look, you've had an amazing career, Tom, right? And so when you look back at your career, what are the memories you have of your sort of two times you've been at London Welsh?
I think, obviously, that championship winning season was great. And some of the things that we did as a team in the Premiership season, even though we were getting battered every week, like what we're trying to do from a camaraderie point of view was brilliant. But look, going back to London Welsh, I never really had the opportunity, and it comes back to what I talk about with Oscar. I never really had the opportunity to play with my mates and have a few beers afterwards. And that was the sole reason. Sounds quite a weird reason to go back and play, but it brings rugby back to being what it should have been, which was a hobby and something I was doing because I enjoyed it. Whereas prior to that, you enjoy it, but it's a job, right? So there's a lot more, it's very different. So, you know, being able to play in those games and go into the clubhouse afterwards and have a few beers with the boys was brilliant, and that's what I loved. And that's what's tempts me when I get these stupid WhatsApps from Kai and Will, you know, to do it again.
Look, you should do. Look, we've enjoyed having you at the club. We've enjoyed seeing you play again at London Welsh. And we will follow your post-rugby career with lots of interest. But you know where we are. Come down and visit. Come and say hello. Come and watch some games. But again, thanks for your time today, Tom.
No problem.